Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
Hi, I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer, and this is Between the Rows. On this week's show, Canada and Britain now have a free trade agreement, sort of. Also, we'll look at the latest trend in the world of finance, something called ESG investing. Finally, we'll find out if canola prices are about to hit a ceiling or not. Last weekend, the federal government announced an interim free trade deal with the United Kingdom. Beginning January 1st, Canada's free trade deal with Europe, known as CETA, will no longer apply to the UK. Here to explain the deal and the implications for Canadian farmers is Claire Cito, Executive Director of the Canadian Agri-Food Trade Alliance. Hi, Claire. Thanks for coming on Between the Rows. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So, as you know, on the weekend, the federal government announced that it has an interim free trade deal with the UK. What does that mean? What is an interim free trade agreement in this case?
Well, our understanding of this interim agreement is that essentially it rolls over the terms of the CETA agreement, which is the deal, the free trade agreement we have with the European Union, over to the United Kingdom as of January 1st. You know that the UK is to leave the EU from a trade perspective. So our understanding is that the intent of the interim agreement is to roll over the terms of the CETA over to the UK for a transition period. For us, what this does, even though the text has not been made available yet, is it seems to present benefits for some sectors of the agri-food industry, as it allows our exporters to maintain existing benefits and access, essentially locks in concessions that exist at the time, and it provides the sector much stability than, of course, a no-deal scenario. So that's positive for a portion of our membership, but it also creates significant risks for others within the agri-food sector, because a transitional arrangement is reinforce actually a bad situation. For example, on the cattle and the beef side of things, the industry is concerned about trade obstacles. We currently have trade obstacles that hinder our access to the EU market. So the beef sector is concerned about viable access to the UK market as well. This at a time the UK and the EU are sending quite a bit of products in terms of meat in particular to Canada. So our main message is that there's a need to re-engage with the UK almost immediately towards a comprehensive agreement, either bilaterally or through the CPTPP. The purpose is really to achieve a commercially meaningful deal that provides real access to the UK UK market. So we are not describing this as a symbol of free and open trade. This is interim trade arrangement. Certainly, this is one thing. It provides stability for some sectors during a transition period, and that is one thing. A real permanent trade agreement that provides ambitious outcomes and enables really the sector to grow is another one.
So just to be clear, the issue with pork, beef and other ag commodities going into Europe is mostly around non-tariff trade barriers. That's what's preventing Canadian access to Europe and UK in general?
That's really it. There is a number of trade barriers, red tape, approvals, timely approvals that we're not seeing. A number of commitments were made in the EU, in the CETA by the EU, and today we're not seeing the EU abide by these commitments. So I think it's really important to understand that the problems are not in the text, in the CETA text itself. They really are with the EU's reluctance to abide by commitments and remove the barriers that would allow our exports to grow.
So in terms of the UK, you know, I've looked at some of the numbers of, say, pork, beef exports from Canada to the UK. It seems like that part of Europe, or what used to be Europe, those exports from Canada have grown a little bit, or at least more so than, say, exports of places like France, Germany, and other places in continental Europe. Is that correct?
I think what is important to note is that overall, and the exports fluctuate on an annual basis, but if you look at the five years on average, the UK has absorbed at least a quarter of our total exports to the EU on 27. So it is one of our largest and long-standing trading partners in Europe, depending on the volumes and the value. And this really varies depending on the commodities. But at times, it's the highest value market for some of our commodities in Europe. So it is the largest market for Canadian beef, common wheat, the second largest market for grains, the fourth market for pork, and also an important market for processed food products, pulses, sugar-containing products, amongst others. The other thing too, and this is not really widely known, but depending on the stats you look at, people don't necessarily know that a lot of our EU exports are recorded as going to the EU for the most part, and then not necessarily to the UK. So sometimes the numbers we see about exports going to the UK are much lower than what really transpires in reality. We're sending products to the continental EU that end up in the UK when they are further processed or redistributed over there. So it's a market that could be for commodities much more important than at times what numbers really show.
So what needs to happen next? You know, obviously, as you mentioned in the CETA text, you know, that's not really the issue. It sounds like the issue is in terms of like the spirit of free trade needs to be sort of enhanced or mobilized. Do you think that is possible through conversations with UK leaders? Like, what do you hope happens here?
Well, certainly it's important that the terms of the agreements, that the rules are respected. And this is one message that we're actually sending to negotiators, officials, and the government. There's been much focus in recent years about Canada's large agreements that have been signed and ratified in recent years, the CETA, the CPTPP, the CUSMA free trade agreement. But now we need to move more into an FTA aftercare mode, where we're going to look a lot more closely at the implementation and the enforcement of those issues.
Last one, in terms of timing, do you think a comprehensive free trade deal with the UK is realistic in 2021, or is 2022 more, you know, more a probable timeline?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, and so I will not speculate on that. But of course, immediately, what's important is it goes without saying that with the UK finally leaving the EU customs union here at the end of December, we cannot let Brexit disruption further disadvantage our exporters. So timing truly is of the essence. It's important that we have an interim agreement that is to provide stability, that is in place by January 1st. And we also have heard the commitments made by leaders and the trade ministers as well to commit to returning to the negotiating table in 2021. So we urge them to stick to that timeline.
Thanks, Claire. Appreciate you coming on the show, and have a good evening.
Thank you. You too as well.
That was Claire Citeau of the Canadian Agri-Food Trade Alliance, who discussed the interim trade deal between Canada and Britain. In a report this July, RBC Wealth Management said ESG investing is the next megatrend in the world of money management. ESG, or environmental, social, and governance investing, favors companies and industries that protect the environment, protect human rights, and give back to their communities. Andrea Gruza, Vice President of Capital Markets with Bonafield, an Ontario company that invests in Canadian farmland, joins us to speak about ESG investing and what it means for Canada's ag sector. Hey, Andrea, thanks for coming on Between the Rows. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with kind of a basic question. What is ESG investing and why is it relevant for Canada's ag sector?
Sure. You know, you may think that it's a basic question, what is ESG investing? But it's actually quite a bit more complicated than one might anticipate. And, you know, it really is because ESG investing isn't necessarily a widely agreed upon term. And the definitions and parameters around ESG in the investing community really are evolving. So it's a fairly broad topic. I certainly can't do it full justice, but hopefully through this discussion, I can provide a good overview of some of the key elements. So, you know, if you think about ESG, it's an acronym and it stands for environmental, social, and governance factors. The term certainly has become pretty widely recognized and adopted across multiple industries over the last few years, not just within finance. And you're hearing from, you know, the majority of large, sophisticated investors across the globe. So those are the likes of pension funds or big asset managers, that they do pursue some form of ESG investing. But this really can mean different things for different investors. So the way I think about it is that, you know, at its most fundamental level, ESG investing simply refers to incorporating ESG, environmental, social, and governance factors, those considerations into your investment decisions, really with the purpose of fully evaluating whether a company is being thoughtful about its long-term drivers of value and how these might be impacted as we, you know, go through the next 5, 10, 25 years, given what's happening in the world around us. So if you think about it in the context of agriculture, a really simple example, you know, in the context of farmland, this could simply mean that, you know, an ESG investor is interested in knowing that that farm operator is maintaining, you know, maybe appropriate crop rotations and good practice to ensure soil health. Because without healthy soil, you don't have strong crop yields and the farm business will suffer. So that at a high level, I think, is ESG investing. I think it's important to recognize that this is different from another term that your listeners may have heard, which is impact investing.
Okay.
And the way I think of impact investing is that it takes ESG considerations and it builds upon them to have those investors only invest in companies that are pursuing some form of activity that is a bit more active. It enhances or improves a set of conditions. For example, it has an impact. So an example, taking that same kind of, you know, example of a farmland investment, it could mean that an impact investor would pursue, you know, an investment in some form of regenerative agriculture, or maybe some type of investment where the operator is taking on polluted lands and cleaning them up. So it really does have a significantly more active element to it, but that really is a subset and a step beyond at its basic, you know, the general ESG investing concept.
Okay. So from what I've read, my limited knowledge of ESG investing, it seems like more money is flowing into funds that, you know, focus on ESG investing or what you described as impact investing. Is that fair to say that this sort of trend or this approach or philosophy is attracting more capital and more investors are kind of putting their money in this area?
I think that's fair to say. I wouldn't say impact investing is necessarily attracting more capital. I think it's growing over time, but it's certainly by no means a mainstream investment consideration. But ESG certainly is, you know, relevant to almost all investors nowadays, certainly from an institutional perspective. And I think it goes across all sectors where, again, you know, investors are really just incorporating those ideas and concepts into their investment decision. Some investors are taking it further and maybe taking a bit more of a sophisticated or structured approach to how they think about investments. But it's hard to find an investor nowadays who isn't in some way at least aware of and in some level considering, you know, certain ESG characteristics when they're evaluating an investment.
So this bringing this back to the ag sector. So in my work as a journalist, you know, I get dozens and dozens of news releases from agricultural companies. And quite often they're sort of highlighting their sustainability programs. I've never really totally understood why they're so committed to these sustainability programs. Is it connected to ESG investing because they need to be seen as sustainable by investors and money managers who are responsible for pension funds and other folks in the investment sector?
That's a good question. You know, I can't speak to the specifics for every company and what their sustainability programs entail or the specific motivations behind them. I think it's fair to assume that investor interest and concern with ESG factors does influence companies, but this doesn't necessarily have to be the driving reason why a company would have a sustainability program in place. As I mentioned before, the underlying concern here is to really take a step back and take a look at the business, how it's currently performing and how it's then positioned to perform over the next number of years, often long-term, you know, 10, 20 years, given the changing conditions around us. So, you know, if you think about it from that context, that really is an important thing for companies themselves to be thinking about, regardless of whether or not their investors are raising it, because it's part of the critical strategic considerations to ensure that you are, you know, as a company, positioned to weather future changing conditions. And, you know, investors really are getting smarter about those companies who may be just paying lip service to this. It has its own term. It's called greenwashing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think investors can tell if a company is simply writing the words down on a paper and sending it out in a press release, but it doesn't necessarily tie to the drivers of value and you know, relevant strategic decision-making in the corporation. So I think there's a relationship there, but I would hope that those, you know, smart, sophisticated organizations are doing it because it does drive value as opposed to just, you know, hoping to pay lip service to something and hope that nobody catches that.
Fair enough. So can you explain what this all means for your company? Does it affect how you guys operate, or were you already, you know, adopting practices that sort of highlight sustainability in agriculture? Can you just explain that connection between ESG investing, this trend, and what it means for a company like yours?
Sure. So just as a bit of background, Bonnefield Financial is, we provide an alternative source of financing for farmers beyond that of traditional debt. So we're partnering with leading farmers across the country. We will acquire a portion of their farmed acres and lease it back to them on a long-term basis. So really that allows them to free up some of the capital and invest it as they like, maybe in other parts of the business, but they still have long-term access to the farmland, to operate it as they see fit. We don't tell them how or what to farm. So we really are, largely passive landlords. That money that we're using to buy the farmland is coming from investors. So we are obviously, you know, in that role where investors are asking us questions and raising concerns around ESG, as they are with all, you know, companies that they're investing in across the globe. So I think, you know, what we do and what we have done since our founding, and this was over 10 years ago, is that we have in place a set, what we call, you know, our standards of care. It's a set of best practices. The farmers who we work with agreed to adhere to these, and they involve, you know, agronomic principles that really are fairly common in the industry already. It's, you know, maintaining regular crop rotations and ensuring that you are minimizing, there's a plan to mitigate soil erosion, good water management, appropriate use of fertilizer and pesticides, weed control. We did that in the early days before anybody was talking about ESG. So it wasn't intended as a way to communicate to the investor community. It was really intended, as ESG actually is supposed to be, to be a way to preserve the value and ensure that we had a way to protect that the asset, the farmland, is being cared for. So the pressure that we're facing now really is in taking what we're doing and being able to effectively and appropriately communicate it to the investor community in the language that they use. But it's not necessarily changing our approach or what we're doing. And I'd say I'd take that a step further. When you think about the farmers we work with and those in the broader ag community, a lot of the key ESG concepts that link to those to that industry, while farmers aren't necessarily using the language of ESG, many of them are actually doing the activities already because it's good business to do that. You know, it's smart to care for the asset, to invest in the business, to plan for its long-term success. And that really does align very closely with what investors are looking for from ESG practices.
So just to back up a bit. So just in terms of that communication piece. So let's just say I'm a potential investor in Bonnefield and I might ask a question like, okay, tell me what your farmers and the people that you work with are doing to combat greenhouse gas emissions on their farm. Would that be sort of a question that an investor might ask, that sort of thing?
That could be a question that an investor asks. Frankly, we don't have an answer for that because that isn't anything that we have determined as being important in our current model. I'll caveat that with the fact that we are continually reevaluating our ESG metrics and we're actively looking at that right now. But I'd say that combating greenhouse gas emissions falls a bit more into the impact investing bucket than it does with respect to the broader ESG framework. And so that really does take it that step further. I'd say similarly, you may have some investors who have a real interest in saying, I only want to invest in organic farms. That isn't the Bonnefield model. And that really is a very specific investor viewpoint that is taking ESG and narrowing it to have more of an impact focus.
This one here, last question here for you. So I'm trying to understand what this all means for Canadian farmers. I guess my sort of assumption is that, the ones who are, trying to preserve soil health, maintaining a good crop rotation, do things sustainably, they should just sort of like carry on. But it sounds like others may need to kind of get with the program if they want to kind of participate and be part of this sort of ESG investment trend. Is that too simple or how do you see it?
We have to simplify it. I think everybody's situation is unique and I can't speak to all farmers across the country, but I think generally, that's the right way to look at it. I don't think ESG is a trend. I can imagine the terminology around ESG evolving and the set of considerations for each industry changing over time as it better reflects what's happening in the world around us and what factors we think are important. But I do think that, as we learn more and know more, we're just more aware of what things we should be thinking about when we evaluate how a business is performing. And so, I think it comes down to, are you a good operator? And part of being a good operator is not necessarily being a good operator this year, but also being a good operator for the next 5 and 10 years. And if you're not taking care of your equipment and you're not investing in the business, then those who are looking at the business are going to think that it doesn't have that long-term sustainability. So I think you're right that those who are pursuing best practice, it probably is business as usual. But maybe those who may want to participate in some way in that ESG lens, they'd have to take some of those considerations into account.
All right. Thanks, Andrea. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. It was great to speak with you.
That was Andrea Gruza, who works for Bonnefield Financial in Toronto. Finally on today's show, canola and soybean futures have been climbing for more than 3 months. Canola is inching closer to $600 per ton, and soybeans are nearing $12 per bushel US. Market watchers and analysts are wondering if soybeans and canola prices will soon top out, or maybe the ceiling is much higher. Phil Franz Workington, a reporter with Glacier Markets Farm, now joins us to share his thoughts on this question. Hey Phil, thanks for coming on Between the Rows.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I checked the charts before our interview and canola is around $570 per ton. So we're getting close to highs we haven't seen in quite a while. Where are we at relative to prices in the last decade or so?
Yeah, it's you got to go back to 2013, the last time prices were at this kind of level for any extended time frame. The 550 had been a very solid resistance for the past 7 years, I guess. And over the past month or two, we've climbed above that 550 level. It's now support in the rearview mirror, and 600 is the sort of psychological target on heading higher. Canola has run into, we're talking Tuesday morning, and it's kind of backed away a bit, seeing a bit of profit taking, but the overall trend is still in place. And it seems that opinions in the market are that, you know, it has room to go higher and hit that 600 level yet.
So is this all about soybeans? Because soybeans are creeping close to $12 a bushel US. Is this totally driven by soybeans?
Yeah, it's majority soybeans. Canola has its own supportive fundamental story in the background. Exports are running way ahead of the year ago. Domestic crush is still pretty solid. You know, there are ideas that the crop might not have been as big as expected. We'll get new numbers from Statistics Canada next week. So overall, canola is looking in at a tightening supply situation. So that's supportive for canola on its own. But yeah, you're right. The big issue is soybeans, and it's all being driven by South American weather concerns. So it's been dry in Brazil and Argentina, and there's you know, worries their crops won't live up to expectations. So there's been a lot of buying of U.S. beans to compensate for that. Even you know, you see stories that Brazil is even buying beans from the States to fill their own domestic need because they're concerned about their supplies. So that's the driver, and then the Chinese demand is in there as well. They have the demand for these beans that there won't be as many of them in Brazil. So
So it seems to me that this rally sort of came out of nowhere. I mean, did anybody have this on their radar in the summertime that this could potentially happen? Was anybody talking about this back in July and August?
Yeah, I don't remember it being a big topic back then. No. So, the timing of the Brazilian crops, you know, that wasn't really an issue at that point. They're still seeding in some cases now. But yeah, no, it did, it just sort of, in the beginning of the summer, July, that's when it started going higher, and it really hasn't stopped for the past, 5 months now, I think.
So what are folks in the trade calling this? Are they just calling this some sort of weather rally? Like, how are people describing what's happening in the oilseed sector?
Yeah, the weather rally, and it's Brazilian weather. You know, there's a lot of fund money at play as well. So they're following the trend, and so some of those funds could care less about what's going on in Brazil, but they see oh, beans are rising. Let's hook ourselves onto this trend. So there's some of that, and it sort of feeds on itself and drives things, bumps things more than they might otherwise. But yeah, at the base of it, it's the supply tightness concerns being driven right now by Brazilian weather issues. The U.S., their soybeans was at a couple of weeks ago now. They had ending stocks projections from the USDA, and they came in way below what people were expecting. So the U.S. supply situation is tighter than expected, and that's fueling it as well.
So I'll put you on the spot here. Do you think $600 a ton canola is possible before the end of 2020?
I think it's I'd say it looks possible. It could just as there's an equally likely scenario that we hit a top and something happens. You know, there's a big rain in Brazil and the weather concerns aren't there anymore, and then it all comes crashing down. But right now, all things being equal, the trend is still higher, so it's that is a possibility, but highly weather dependent. And if it stays dry where those concerns are in the South America right now.
So let's just shift to wheat for a second. So this has been going on for several months now that Chicago wheat futures are trading above Minneapolis futures, which is unusual because Minneapolis futures represents spring wheat, which normally trades at a premium to the Chicago sort of soft wheat futures contract. What's going on? Like, why is this discrepancy persisted?
Yeah, it's about, we got Chicago wheat so trading over $6 a bushel right now, and Minneapolis is around that 550 to 560 level. And yeah, you're right. Usually Minneapolis is at a premium of 50 cents to a dollar, as much as $2 or more in some cases. And it's less a case of anything to do with spring wheat and more to do with bigger kind of world wheat trends. So if you look at the cash prices, spring in the country, basis levels and whatnot, spring wheat is still trading at a premium to the other wheat. So that at the cash level, spring wheat is still finding support, but the futures are their own beast, I guess, and they are the Chicago is the king of the wheat futures. So that one gets the most interest from funds, and if anyone is trading, commercials need to hedge. Chicago's the easiest one to hedge.
That's the most liquid contract.
It's the most liquid contract, yeah. So there's concerns in the Black Sea region over their crops. There's some issues with the U.S. Wheat. Their condition ratings were downgraded recently. Russia is putting in measures to slow exports to shore up their own domestic supplies. So that all is sending a signal to the market that, we might need to ration some wheat demand, and that boosts wheat prices overall. And when they're overall being supported, Chicago sees the most of that. So the, typically in the, in my years covering this, spring wheat would be on top, then the Kansas City hard red winter wheat, and then Chicago would be the lowest priced of all of them, but it's completely flipped around right now. And Kansas City's over Minneapolis in some contract months as well. It's mainly a story of there's tight wheat supplies, concerns of the production in some parts of the world, and that money is flowing into Chicago before the other contracts on the future side. But yeah, like I said, the basis levels, it looks to me like the spring wheat, there's still premiums for the kind of higher quality protein levels that spring wheat represents. But that's on the cash side, not finding its way into the futures right now.
On that note, thanks again for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was Phil Franz-Workington, a reporter with Glacier Markets Farm. That's it for this week's edition of Between the Rows. I'm Robert Arneson of the Western Producer. Thanks for listening. And to our American friends, happy Thanksgiving.
Between the Rows is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Experience the latest, most efficient fertilizer system for delivering sulfur and phosphate to your crops when they need it. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.